this is a great honor for me, certainly.
I don't know about this.
So how old are you now?
I'll be 86 this year.
Do you remember?
Or 85.
Do you remember when you were born, what year it was?
1930.
1930.
Yeah, so what do we know?
And?
Next month.
Next month. No, okay. November I'll be.
November, 2 months. Martino's.
And the reason I remember is because our daughter said, oh, this is great because you will be able to celebrate your golden wedding when we celebrate our silver wedding. So that happened yesterday.
Oh, wow.
But it wasn't possible because my dear wife died a couple of years too soon.
Yep.
So life happens, as you know.
Yep. And death is part of life, I'm afraid.
Oh, yes. It was a nice thought.
So where were you born?
London. Wood Green, suburb of London.
Oh, wow. And but you moved not around far. A bit, didn't you? You didn't...
Right. Well, we were locked into being in Britain because of wartime pretty soon after I was born. That made me want to get out. I guess.
What did your father do? What business was he in?
He was became a Waldorf teacher after he and his very young wife had said, shall we ask grandfather to buy this farm for us? And she said, no, no, we're going back to Britain to that new school that's just started where you're going to be a teacher.
Oh, wow.
So she was quite a personality.
Waldorf schools.
So, it was the first one in the English-speaking world.
He started it?
With others, yeah. He came a little bit later, a few weeks later.
So tell me as much as you can, remember, about, you know, your growing up, where you grew up, and how you got interested in the things you got interested in.
Well, I was always interested in technical things, how things worked. I would like to know that. And so I have particular joy in the way people work physically with the material world. But then I realized there was more at stake than just the physical world, because people get stressed and so on, and things like that happen. That caused me to eventually inquire about anthroposophy, because I became interested in what my parents' philosophy was.
And what was that word again?
Anthroposophy.
Anthroposophy.
Correct.
Excellent. And what is anthroposophy?
It's the name that Steiner gave to his philosophy and lectures that he was interested in more spiritual matters, to try and help them to deal with materialism in a way that would help them understand and make it useful for them.
And you said Stanley?
Steiner.
Oh.
Rudolf Steiner, in other words.
Steiner.
Yeah.
Mr. Rudolf Steiner. Okay.
Because my wife and my mother, I mean, was actually a pupil in the first Waldorf school in Stuttgart. And Steiner was asked by the doctor, Kulisko, what can I do with this child? She has bad skin. And Steiner looked at her and said, she needs to, and told her, you need to have a piece of bread with onions every day, just one. She pulled a face. And he said, but you want to get better, don't you? And she really loved him very, very dearly because he was such a wonderful man. And he visited the Waldorf school quite frequently because it was his baby. And the kids would run to him and hang on his arms and swing.
Holy smokes. So did Mr. Steiner actually start the Waldorf school, or what was his association with it?
No, that was started by Emil Malt, who was director and maybe owner of the Waldorf cigarette factory.
Oh, wow. Where was that located?
In Stuttgart. And that's why it's called the Waldorf School because of the cigarettes.
Well, actually, there are benefits to smoking tobacco, supposedly, but not contaminated tobacco.
Right.
I was actually surprised because I don't smoke. I've never smoked, but then somebody that actually knows some stuff was telling me, well, there are benefits to it. And of course, Native American people were smoking for long time.
Yeah,
this is my great grandmother.
Yeah. So, the Waldorf School is known by that name, and it's quite a movement. Over 1,000 schools now around the world, as far as I know. And I don't know how many in America, but it's grown as a movement. And what it is, it's run under a different kind of management. I don't think all schools quite understand it yet, but on the whole, the benefits are huge, because if you have group management instead of hierarchical structure, you're confronted with a serious problem, then they will sit together, the ones responsible, they belong to the so-called College of Teachers, in other words, they regard themselves as a college and a collegiate group, and we're all equal, so we're stuck with a conundrum, and we sit together in this circle and begin to debate what is the best thing to do. And not knowing what is the best thing to do, it takes quite a while to get out the essence of what that group would favor. But there's a certain moment when you suddenly realize, oh, I know what the decision is. And who else knows? And you look around, so some are still talking, some obviously know. And then I ask myself, when did we come to the decision? And I realize there's no way to spot it when the decision was in that moment. Was it 2 minutes ago? Was it 5 minutes ago?
It emerged.
That's right. And it's amazing because it's as if you were sitting in a circle with your colleagues, and behind each one is their angel advising or trying to.
Fantastic.
And there's a certain moment when that comes together as a kind of
field.
Yes, or you could say chalice. So that chalice then can receive a drop of wisdom from the hierarchies. So you know there are 9 hierarchies?
Oh, tell me about this.
Well, if you go to St. Paul's Cathedral, you see the names of the 9 hierarchies. I'm afraid I don't know them quite well.
Oh, I can look that
up. Angels, archangels, archai, the gotcha. First 3. So there's...
So in Christian dogma.
Yeah, that's right. There's another baptistry in Florence, where all the 9 hierarchies are depicted, every one of them, in layers of mosaic stone, beautifully designed.
So you use a non-hierarchical process to get wisdom through the hierarchy?
Right.
That's interesting.
Let them do what they're supposed to and advise us. But it gets you to become equals with each other before they can advise us.
Ah.
So that's what brings us to another level of decision making. And I can tell you it's magic when it works. I've experienced it once, but the magic of that once was so huge.
So what?
So forgotten it.
Why only once, with as much exposure as you've had to these things?
Because the decision was never so difficult.
Oh wow! So you experienced it at when you were involved with one of the most difficult decisions you had to make.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
For the school.
Wow. Was it an existential decision?
Very much so. Yes. Would have become, if we'd taken the wrong turn.
Wow.
Could have been disaster.
And was the founder there to, as part of that discussion?
The founding group was there, yes.
Founding group. So it was a group that founded it, not just an individual.
Right. It was two ladies. When to Rudolf Steiner asked if they could start a Waldorf school in England. And he said, yes, but you have to have a man with you.
That's interesting.
So they went and produced a man. And then he helped them get started.
Do you remember the names of those two women? Don't worry if you can't.
Effie Grace Wilson, I do believe, was one of them. And I'm not sure who the other one was.
Wow.
But I can find out for you. It's all in a book on Michael Hall School, written by a schoolmate of my sister's. Ex-schoolmate.
And what was the name of the book?
I don't know. Michael Hall, probably.
And so tell me again what Rudolf Steiner's role was in the Waldorf school, besides that he liked it and showed up a lot. Was he one of the founding members also?
In a way, one could say that it wouldn't have been founded without him.
Tell me more if you can. Was he the inspiration behind it?
Yes, or his anthroposophy that inspired Emil Malt to bring this to his workers, his factory workers in the cigarette factory. And actually it was the factory workers themselves who said, what we're learning from Rudolf Steiner is so important, it would be more important for our children than for us. So that really brought about the Waldorf School.
Wow, perfect. That's why I'm saying I'm so happy to have this opportunity, because you were there, you know, you with these major figures and these major movements that, if they were totally appreciated, could do wonders for humanity.
You're right.
But as a friend of mine said, she isn't looking to change the world. She's just looking for that 1 to 5 million in the world that are willing to change, that can then make the difference and create the field for change.
There you go. And then you get all the ridicule you want. You have to find your way through.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, determined people like yourself and others, I don't think we're deterred by that too much, are we? Because we've made a certain decision about how we want to lead our life.
Exactly. And we have to stay true to it. And there are all kinds of temptations to get us off it.
Yeah, but that's just a test. But
that's right.
You know, to help us with our learning.
You know all about that.
To help us with our learning.
But I recognize that you have the necessary aggressiveness to really get through that porridge.
So the point is that power can be used very beneficially.
Absolutely.
And so there's a sense that all power is bad and all power corrupts, but I think that's quite an erroneous belief.
Oh, yes. There's different levels, of course, and different stages of that process which you've been through, and I guess I have too.
I guess you have.
But, you know, I also experienced the disaster of the problems that the Anthroposophical Society and its members got into after he died. Because I was born 5 years after Steiner's death, in more or less, and just under 5 years. And this was devastating for my parents. And I think on one occasion they had an argument because of the split. One was more on the one side and the other was more on the other side, and I don't know whether that was the cause of that, but my father told me that after that argument they had with each other, they swore never to quarrel again because they had upset me so much by it. And I wasn't to be comforted. And that really shocked them.
Wow.
And they realized it would be damaging to this little sensitive creature here. So that was interesting that he told me that at a certain moment in my life, and I realized I guess I was rather sensitive.
Well, you also taught him an important lesson, didn't you, at an early age?
I guess, yeah.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a sister, 4 years younger, now in Australia with her daughter.
So you were born 5 years after Mr. Steiner died.
Right.
And you were there to see the changes in the group afterwards, which were quite unpleasant.
Yeah, when I was six or something. I think it was in 1936.
So tell me a little bit about what those changes were that you were seeing going on, and also if you could reflect on this tendency towards polarization there seems to be in the world.
You're right. Well, it happened in 1936, and what has been interesting for me is that people who voted for the separation in those days at that meeting, which was rather dramatic, two people have, so to speak, confessed to me that they voted the wrong side.
After the fact.
After the fact. Mature, highly respected people that were in my area of work because they were giving lectures and things.
And what was the issue?
In the lectures that they gave?
No, the issue that divided these people.
I wouldn't even attempt to try to tell you, I don't know. It never really got clear.
Oh, wow, that's interesting in itself.
Because they... Well, I've also heard that Steiner's mission was to unite. This doesn't make sense without the sense of reincarnation. To unite different streams of humanity for the next step. So instead of polarization, we have this chalice imagination for the possibility of a unified action for a diverse group. So I guess that's part of the magic.
Not exactly the New World Order, is it? It's a, quite a different concept. It's not by force.
That's right. And people are not always at that self-esteem rest that allows them to join others together in a conversation.
So to maintain your diversity, but yet develop consensus.
Yeah, absolutely. And recognize what consensus is beyond yourself. And
because
not be bothered by any lack of self-esteem.
Because you have an intention to do the right thing by yourself and others.
Right, with others.
And with others.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you recognize that psychopathy exists?
Oh, yes.
So the intentionality of those folks can never be pure.
Right.
So
endlessly pure.
And so how do you deal with them? Are they always outcasts, basically? It depends on us to develop?
Well, it depends on whether they have a karmic connection from a previous life or not. Because there are certain things that you have as a bad habit with each other that you can hardly ever get rid of. And in the end, there's some event, which is why you were brought together to meet that event and be tested by it and overcome the difficulties that came out of the original mistake that was made somewhere.
So Rudolf's philosophy plus your own is one of reincarnation in a way, of souls that continue to learn and use this domain as a learning opportunity?
Right. Yeah. And there are different things that we have to learn at different times. And the spirituality had to be lost in order to really become yourself and make decisions that were not guided by other worlds unless you ask for it.
So in other words, to effectively learn the lessons you needed to, you actually had to separate yourself from the spiritual.
Right.
And then get to the point where you could basically tap into it again.
That's right.
After you've learned those lessons and evolved.
It's kind of a cycle. But if the whole of humanity gets to be too materialistic, you need some disasters to clear things up. So, and you know about that. You're already dealing with it, with what you've done previously. Helps humanity have what they need.
So where are we now, when you look with all your wisdom and experience? Where are we in the cycle now, in your opinion?
I'm not used to being called.
You're not used to what? You're not used to being asked that question? I'm surprised, because you're the type of person that needs to be asked that question. So tell me, where are we, big boss, in this thing?
You know how to get to the bottom of things. That's good. Can you verbalize the question again?
Absolutely. If life is about these cycles that individuals are going through, where they basically have to separate themselves from the spiritual, go through their learning, and then so that they can reconnect at almost a higher level with that again, with better understanding. But that when the world gets too materialistic, sometimes there needs to be something that shakes it up in a form of a disaster, potentially. So where are we now as you look at the world in terms of that cycle? Are we headed for disasters? Have we lost our way? Are there pockets of understanding among enough people to pull us out of this, where we're going, or what? How do you see it?
Looking at this chalice that I experienced, I would say that we're still in it and are looking forward to some pretty bad disasters. But that's necessary in order to awaken people's initiative, I suppose, to do something about it beyond themselves and get to know all the many tests that are involved in taking steps forward. So where are we? There are different regions of the earth right now, of course, that are all at different stages. So different stages, different groups have different things to deal with at different times. I could show you a video, maybe later on, where that question is approached. I think every individual needs to go through a time of losing the orientation somehow, to really search it for themselves and research where they are in connection with humanity as a whole. But that also means you have to really be interested in world affairs, and before you can do that, and learn a few hard lessons and some shocking facts And not all souls are mature enough to stand that. So that's why we have a lot of people in psychological hospitals.
They can't deal with it.
No.
They can't deal with the real deal.
Right. Luckily, we have these wonderful helpers that take care of these people and, of course, are learning a lot that way. I think we're in a moment of danger right now, because when the nutrition is non-nourishing, I don't know how people are going to live.
Someone told me from studies that they had done that the nutrition in our food has probably been depleted by about 40% over the last 50 years or so.
Yeah,
is that right. What you find also?
I would say that's true.
I want to understand how you went from the Waldorf school and Rudolf Steiner to food. Tell me about that transition.
I mean, I'm just beginning to understand that it's food. But when I left, it was because there was a need in the high school for some solutions, and I had a solution and I wanted to check it out and maybe implement it. And a colleague of mine said, no. And I thought, well, at this stage, I've read so many things by Steiner that I want to do so many other things as well. Maybe this is the time to say goodbye and get
in down. High school?
No, no. As a well, I've lived out from 21 to 28. This was, I think I was probably somewhere around 28. I'm not sure. Anyway, I didn't come back to the school to teach in it until I'd been away for 10 years or something, at least 7.
And are you going through your, you know, junior high, high school, and education in London, in England, or are you in Germany?
Yeah, doing in
England. And did you go to university in England?
No, I went to take an apprenticeship somewhere in Stuttgart, which enabled me to go and work, because I was desperately happy, so to speak, to not have to sit in England because of the war. The war ended in 1945, and what I also hadn't realized, I'd already met my wife while still a high school student in Stuttgart, and then I emigrated to Canada and lived there for 2 years, and that's where I got interested in education, thought I might like to be a teacher. There was a 9-month crash course in teaching, and the psychologist professor slammed his fist on his desk and said, for God's sake, it's all right looking at these theories that I'm teaching you, but do have your heart in the right place? And I thought, well, at least he's noticing these abstract theories. And so I decided I want to find out what Waldorf School does. So that's how I went back to the Waldorf School to get a training in Waldorf education in Britain.
In Britain.
And they were short of teachers, so they just popped me into a class and never gave me any training.
On the job training.
That's right. So I did that and was given a class of kids that had lost their teacher, and did that until I'd been through completing that class and starting a new one, which I then asked to leave because I'd met my wife and needed to go to Germany for a while. No, Switzerland. So I worked with her on various things.
So, born in London, you end up going to Stuttgart.
After Canada. Two years in Canada.
Then to Canada.
Yeah.
Then back to the UK to teach.
Yes.
And then to Switzerland.
Yes.
And at this point, had food in an important way entered your life, or just
no.
just education?
My mother was a good cook. But in Switzerland, I learned how to speak Swiss German. And then when they finally came to the point where they'd ask, "Bist Ausland Schweizer?" I'd say, "Nein, ich bin Engländer." And then my status in Switzerland dropped two rungs on the ladder.
Oh, because you spoke so well, they didn't think you were English, huh?
Yeah. So I thought, well, you keep your country to yourselves. If that's the case, I'm going somewhere else, back to the British English-speaking world.
So, okay, so we're away from Europe, we're in Canada, you're going through some training.
Yes.
You went back to the UK to teach.
To learn how to teach.
And you ended up teaching because they needed a teacher.
Yeah.
How long were you there then in the UK teaching?
8 years.
8 years.
You did a full class, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I completed
the first one and then the second one, but altogether it was only eight. Well, my dear wife showed up. Mm-hmm. Then we went back to Switzerland. Then we went to Switzerland.
That's when you went to Switzerland. Okay.
Yeah. And that was also when Maggie Thatcher, I think, had increased the taxes for the rich to the point where I decided that's not going to be. Because the government has no business taking all our money. There's too much we have to do with it.
Exactly.
So that started me off on this search for what do I really need to do. Yeah, it's interesting.
So tell me, here you are, the world is creating a situation that's forcing you to continue to search for what's going to be most meaningful for you. And so, is at that point you start to become interested in food?
Yes. That was mainly my wife. And she wanted to make sure that America gets enough understanding of biodynamics. And I joined her in this.
So your wife actually had an interest in biodynamics even before you did?
Long before. Her father bought a farm which he'd get turned over to biodynamics in Germany, and that's where she always went during the war holidays, school holidays, until the war became too dangerous and they were in Garmisch for quite a while. She is one of five girls.
So did you guys leave England together and come to the United States?
Yeah.
Do you remember about when that was?
1978, was it?
1978 sounds right.
And where did you move to? Where did you first come?
To the United States?
Yes. What area?
Well, we wanted to increase the biodynamic knowledge.
But where did you come? Where did you settle here in this area?
We found where there was biodynamic activity, and we researched five different areas and decided on East Troy because of the biodynamic farm, which is the oldest one, still going.
And where that farm is in East Troy?
Yeah.
Wisconsin?
That's Wisconsin.
And it's the oldest biodynamic farm in the United States.
Yeah, called the Zeneca Farm.
Zeneca.
And Max and Matilda Zeneca were married in Chicago. He was a gardener. And he went out into the garden with his flashlight one night and saw the vitality and fertility and the life of the compost pile. That was biodynamic because the people he was working for as a gardener had decided they wanted biodynamic compost, and he was so touched by what he saw in the compost that he agreed to their suggestion to get a farm. So I guess he went north until he could afford a farm and started in East Troy.
So compost gave him the inspiration.
That's right. That's what he told me.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So what is biodynamics?
It's an education in learning to recognize the interplay of stars and particularly planets, their influence on material, mainly life material, living material, plants, and of course animals and humans. If you recognize the interplay of the different qualities, then what we've learned, what we can learn from the Chinese sometimes, you recognize has a cosmic background because of the totality of our solar system.
So is it just gravitational fields, or is it much more than that?
Oh, much more than that. In my bedroom, I've got a set of will you come with me?
Oh, yes. And what are these?
These are representational designs of the forces of the different planets. That's why they're called seals, planetary seals. And somebody who is mobile and flexible, and maybe they have a copper quality, but it may be more mercurial. So this is Mercury. The names are on the back, you can pick them up.
And are these different metals also?
Yes. Related to the planets.
So here's Mercury. And do you know the metal that's associated with Mercury?
Quicksilver.
And here...
Sometimes called Mercury.
And here is Saturn.
Yeah, that's sort of the furthest away planet.
And what metal is associated with that?
Lead. That's copper.
And here's Venus, which is copper. And here is the Sun, which is gold. Wow. And here is Jupiter, which is... What metal is that?
Now that I'm not sure of.
And this is Mars.
These are all things that Michael Fields wants to teach. And they would tell the students what the different influences are from the different planets. But we have to find the right teacher for that. And it's not me.
But Michael Fields Institute was quite into this.
Was founded in order to be able to teach this.
No kidding.
Yeah.
This specifically, the significance of the planets as represented by these seals.
Yeah. We only have one home planet.
One second. Hello?
Hey, you got 2 seconds?
It's Catherine Austin Fitz. Yeah.
Catherine Austin Fitz.
Go ahead. Hi, Catherine.
I'm sitting with Dr. Chris Mann.
Oh, fantastic.
I've been thinking about you a lot these years.
Since sending lots of love.
Do you remember when you first came to visit me? Suddenly
yes,
in the middle.
Of course I do. How could I forget? You tried to persuade me to read all 100 books of Steiner. I've never since.
But what you did say, suddenly breaking into the conversation at that time, oh, now I know I had to come to East Troy. I had to meet anthroposophy. Do you remember that?
Yep, I do.
And that's that really surprised me. I thought, well, if you already recognize anthroposophies through the few things I've said, that's pretty good. Thank you.